You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 102. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about revisiting with Dr. Llewellyn. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples, Treaty Land, the Dineta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Dr. Ayana Omilade Llewellyn on the show. Dr. Llewellyn uses they, she pronouns. Dr. Llewellyn is a Black feminist, an archaeologist, an artist scholar, and a storyteller. Dr. Llewellyn is the co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists and sits on the board of Diving with Purpose. They are an assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at Stanford University. Her research and teaching interests address Black feminist theory, historical archaeology, memory, maritime heritage conservation, public and community-engaged archaeology, processes of identity formations, and representations of slavery and its afterlives. So Dr. Llewellyn was a previous guest on Heritage Voices on episode 60, which was Historical Archaeology for the Future. So if you haven't listened to that episode previously, or if you had and need a refresher, because it's been about 4 years, I highly recommend going back to episode 60, Historical Archaeology for the Future, before listening to this follow-up episode to make sure that you get the full maximum benefit of listening to Dr. Llewellyn. So welcome back to the show, Ayana. It's been almost just under 4 years, which kind of blew my mind when I listened back to our episode. I guess I should say it was almost 4 years since we recorded. It took a little bit for that episode to launch, but we recorded last in November of 2021, and here we are again in late September of 2025, and it is a different world.
It really is. Thank you so much.
Of course. What you have been up to for the past 4 years, and yeah, it was really fun re-listening to our episode together and excited to hear more about where everything went.
I'm excited to share more. And also just wanting to acknowledge that I have the privilege of being able to record on Mwekma Ohlone tribal land. So just giving a huge space of gratitude, really, for these people who have stewarded this land and continue to steward this land here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, love it. So, okay, I guess let's start with an update, kind of maybe a general update on what you've been working on for the past 4 years, or like, you know, take us back to November 2021 and go from there a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So November of 2021, I feel like I submitted an application for the position that I currently have here at Stanford in October of that year. And in November, I feel like we must have recorded maybe a week or two before I did a job talk on Stanford's campus. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which was like, I think that was the first talk I did post-pandemic. You know, wow, like that's okay. How I like remember things, like first talk I did in person, you know?
Okay.
And
well, it was clearly effective since spoiler alert, you're working at Stanford.
And I'll say like the last talk that I had given in person before the pandemic was also at Stanford. It was in January of that year. Yeah, when I was a postdoc, I went down and I'd given a lunch talk there. And I remember I left that space thinking that these people hated me. I was like, I don't think they were interested at all in my work. So it was so interesting, like, you know, hop forward to 2021. And I was just like, okay, I'm giving a job talk. I think somewhere in between that, there was the TAG conference that also happened on Stanford's campus. And Professor Ian Hodder at the time had actually asked me to put together a plenary panel just on Black feminist archaeology. And I was like, oh, I can really put together a really amazing group of scholars that are doing work both in historical context, which most people think of when they think of Black feminist work. But I was like, oh no, we're going to get Dr. Sterling to talk about how she's using Black feminist theory to talk about Paleolithic sites. Like I was really jazzed about it. So we were able to really span the kind of gamut on how people were, you know, applying Black feminist theory within archaeology. So that I feel like is somewhere online, but it was a really fantastic programming. So yeah, so between that in-person talk was that tag talk. And then I gave this job talk in November.
Ah, yeah. Bookended the, wow, that's cool.
Yeah. So I felt like, you know, gave that talk. I was really, you know, jazzed about it and ended up getting that position, which I was really shocked over because it was an open call. And I imagine that hundreds, and I'd learned that hundreds of people had applied for that. So I don't even know how they were able to narrow down their choices because there's just so many amazing people doing great work in the world right now. So had gotten that position and then made a really tough choice for me to leave the University of California, Riverside, where I've been doing some really amazing work with scholars there, helping to develop their Black Studies program on that campus. Had gotten like a Mellon Seminar Sawyer grant to do some work around Black archiving with folks that were in the history department and in English and in anthropology. So yeah, it was a really generative space. So it was hard. It was hard to make that choice to leave, but I definitely feel nourished in the space that I am right now. And I'm grateful for it.
Yeah. Stanford is a beautiful campus. I've only been there once, but I can see how it would be very, yeah, nourishing.
Yeah, yeah. And the Bay Area itself, you know, I think oftentimes, you know, it can be really challenging to have to grapple with, you know, choosing where to work, right? Or like not even having the choice around like where to work, but also having to contend with the community that surrounds the school as well. Like, am I going to be able to find community that feels
housing.
Generative? Housing, like, thank you for saying it out loud. Like, am I going to be able to afford housing up here? Am I going to be able to, you know, have a community that is politically diverse, that is racially diverse, that, you know, like there, so there are all these questions. So I just feel like the Bay Area, I just feel so blessed in the way that it answers so many wants that I have. Yeah. Yeah. So we're still working on the housing part though.
But you found the community part of it.
I found the community part. We're still working on what an actual house.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The one thing I love to share, and we do not have to like dive down the hole around it, but like, oh my goodness, my mother lives in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And her home was, I think, $150,000. And it's beautiful. 3 bedrooms, has a basement, has a beautiful backyard filled with trees. Like,
my husband is from Michigan and he always used to like look at the real estate stuff there and it was like, don't do that because
don't,
like,
yeah, yeah, because it'll just be really sad.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Because I've literally been saying, oh man, I can get a home in Oakland and it's just $700K. I've been saying just to like to trick my mind into thinking that it's normal.
Wow.
It hasn't worked yet.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Seriously. Okay. That's insane. But, and that's still driving an hour away.
It is. Yeah, it is. Yeah. If I were to look at homes in the South Bay, I'd be looking at least between the $800 to $1.5 million range. And those are, and the homes that start at like 7, 8, 9, like those would be considered starter homes in other areas. So it's really challenging in that regard. really challenging.
So you're telling me that as a Stanford professor, you can't.
I am loving
$1 million house.
I am loving my wonderful one bedroom apartment. It's been great. I have a really nice patio.
Oh my God. Well, that aside, sounds like the community, though, has been more of what you were hoping for, and like academic environment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been really lovely. I mean, you're surrounded by other schools as well, especially like UC Berkeley up north, UC Santa Cruz to our south. It's been really generative in that regard. And then also, you know, I'm someone who is Black, who's queer, who's non-binary, and there's a really beautiful, thriving, just Black queer POC community in Oakland that feels really generative and nourishing. So I'm grateful for that as well.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. So you moved to Stanford. I guess another thing that you talked about on the last episode, I'm not sure if you want to talk more about Stanford stuff first, or if you want to talk about your book that was anticipated in November of 2021. You were teasing your book that was going to be coming out, I think, in 2022. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you want to tell us a little bit more about like where things went at Stanford or about your book first. But
we could definitely talk about the book. And I think it's so cute to think that in 2021, I thought this book was going to come out in 2022. Like, that is so cute of me. This has been a journey. So my book project, The Will to Adorn, Black Women and Sartorial Choice After Enslavement, is built off of my dissertation work. And my dissertation work looked at a legacy collection that was gathered in the 1990s, early 2000s at the Levi Jordan plantation. And I feel like I gave a talk at Stanford about this, about essentially my dissertation work and how I was shifting it into this larger book project talking about sartorial choice and the ways in which Black women used clothing adornment to navigate, you know, the precarity of the post-emancipation era. And legacy collections can be really tricky, especially when there's not a standardization process with how artifacts are cataloged. And I'd done my due diligence as a graduate student, especially under the guidance of like my really fantastic mentor, Dr. Maria Franklin. And this collection, this collection, the Levi Jordan Plantation Collection, has been, you know, canon for so long in historical archaeology on the African diaspora, particularly in a North American context. And I feel like in March of 2022, so it was after I'd given the talk, I probably just gave a talk at Clemson University, I think at the time, when my colleague and friend David Marquez, I don't think he's there anymore, was teaching there. And I got a call from my old advisor, Maria. And she was like, hey, a new tech report came out about some more recent archaeological work that had taken place at the Levi Jordan plantation. And it was really throwing into question some of the findings that had been previously interpreted about that collection and about the site itself. And, you know, evidence, this is science, you know, you introduce new evidence, you test it, you figure out, you know, okay, a new theory around what a possible area could be, its use, fantastic. But for my particular book project, looking at the Levi Jordan collection, I had taken the understanding that like the context of the collection itself came from the quarters of those who were enslaved at that site. And new interpretations suggested that might not be the case, that it could have been a secondary refuge site and the materials could have come from a number of individuals who lived at that site. And we know that the majority of the individuals who lived there were African Americans and they were enslaved. But it also could have come from it could have been the kind of refuse from the enslaver's home as well, the Jordan family. So,
wow. Okay.
Like that's I said, you know, it's a huge shift. And that's not to say that the kind of final interpretation of that site are these new interpretations. There's actually work being done by the professor who initially excavated that site, Ken Brown, who's been writing more about his interpretations and how he came to those interpretations in the 1990s and early 2000s, along with, you know, prior to things shifting, you know, in the sort of political landscape in Texas, more work happening at that plantation site as well, as far as I know. But for me, when I found out about that and, you know, and I had just given this job talk, I'd gotten the job at Stanford in December. Yeah. And, you know, when you're on the tenure clock, you know, the drive to have a book is like right at the forefront. So I had, you know, poured everything into like putting together this book proposal. I was about to shop it around to different editors. And I was like, wow, this is a huge shift. And I remember being like in my hotel at Clemson, like crying over this like information. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And I was everything, like, oh,
totally upended in one moment. That, I mean, I feel like I'm feeling emotional for you. And this was.
Yeah. So I was just like, oh my goodness. Like this is huge. And I also, you know, just wanting to say again, you know, when you are working with, and I keep saying like when you're working with legacy collections, but honestly, like, you know, the work that we do, because we're archaeologists and we're a part of this kind of construction of history, you know, new evidence is always added that shifts and changes interpretations all the time. I didn't want to put all my eggs in one basket, essentially, was what it came down to for me. And I remember I came to the conclusion that I shouldn't use that material for the basis of a book project. Mm-hmm. Out of a deep concern that continuous work that would take place at that site that I did not anticipate, and no one had even asked me at either, but I wasn't anticipating going back to that site, doing further work on it. Like I was very content being someone who used legacy collections to ask new questions about the past, especially at this particular site. But I had just, you know, come to my own conclusion that I was going to shift entirely and just like think about other sites that I could look at and what kinds of questions I could ask of those new sites. Yeah. So that's what I remember like at the forefront of my mind. And I literally, you know, I think it's really beautiful if folks, you know, who are graduate students, early career professors like myself, like doing a kind of mentor map for yourself to like know who are the people that you could reach out to for support and mm-hmm. moments of challenge within your career. And I have like a core group of mentors that I can reach out to. And one of the first people that I called was Jillian Galley, who at the time was working for the Monticello Foundation and is the person who really poured into and birthed the Digital Archaeological Archive of Comparative Slavery. James Davidson, who was a professor at the University of Florida in the Anthropology Department and was my introduction to historical archaeology and the politics within this work, with his work at the Kingsley Plantation. And then, of course, Maria Franklin, who was my dissertation advisor when I went to UT Austin. So those are like the kind of like core people that I can turn towards. And there are certainly others as well, like Lori Wilkie, Bill White. Like I have other people that are like in my corner always rooting for me. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when it's really hard and you're not quite sure the footing that you should take, having those people that you could turn towards and just be vulnerable and say out loud, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know?
Yeah.
Because to get a job anywhere and to like have your first, like the kind of first footing that you have be, okay, I have to come up with a whole new book project. Like that is really challenging. So I called them and I asked them, I said, you know, this is what I'm faced with. I cannot use this collection anymore. So I'm asking if you know of any other legacy collections that have really vibrant clothing and adornment components, assemblages to it that might be able to tell a compelling story about how African-American men, women, and children dress, you know, post-enslavement. And Jillian was the first to say, look at the Hermitage and look at their collection, because they have really beautiful collections coming both from the quarters where enslaved predominantly agricultural laborers lived, and then also those who did more domestic and specialized work at that plantation in Nashville, Tennessee. I had already done work in my dissertation with the Sarah and Ransom Williams Farmstead site. So Maria Franklin was like, talk to Nidra, talk to Doug Boyd about, you know, these, about what could be said about, what more could be said, but beyond what I did in my dissertation about the Sarah and Ransom Williams site. And then James Davidson, he said, you know, you should look at the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery. And there has always been a really vibrant adornment and clothing assemblage that's there. And we don't have the legacy collections for you to look at, but there's a really beautiful database of every single thing that was recovered at that site prior to its reinterment. So those were like the responses that I got. And it was from this like desire to build a story that I began to think, well, if I'm not just talking about clothing and adornment post-enslavement in a kind of Texas, Central Texas sort of region, you know, what else can I sort of share? And from that, I said, okay, well, maybe we can actually just trace an actual journey, right? And look at these three different sites to talk, hopefully, about three different very real women who are a part of bringing this these collections into life, and to say something about how they use dress and adornment in the past.
So I really hate to cut you off because we're talking about really cool things and I really want to come back to it, but we are at our first break point. So we will be right back here in a moment. Okay, back from our break. And I want to just give you the opportunity to keep going because you were really on a roll. So just handing the mic back to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So rather than a book project that was looking predominantly at one specific site, the Levi Jordan Plantation, and those who, you know, lived and labored at that plantation, both during enslavement and afterwards, the book became about three different sites and about three different women who lived at these, who lived and died essentially at these, in these spaces. So I turned first to Nancy, a woman who was enslaved at the Hermitage and who ran away, who absconded from the Hermitage in 1863. And there's a note from her enslaver, Sarah Jackson, that pretty much says that Nancy has run away and she's taken all of her clothing and bedding with her. Huh. So from that particular documentary source, I kind of questioned, well, what could she have taken with her in light of the fact that we don't have evidence of like actual textiles at the site itself, but of course we have all the components and small finds that would have held together various pieces of clothing, and then a lot of clothing maintenance that was also a testament to Nancy, who was documented as also being a seamstress along with her aunt Gracie. And Jillian Galley has done fantastic work on Gracie, who was a seamstress at Andrew Jackson's Hermitage. So that was really fun looking at that site and thinking about, oh, okay, like we're doing an arc, right? So we're looking at the kind of moment of leaving the plantation site. And then I turned towards Sarah and Ransom Williams, who are one of the first Black landowning families in Texas in 1872. I might be off by a year. And I look at the shoes and shoe components at that particular site. And there's so much, there's two volumes, right, of work, archaeological work that had happened and taken place at the Sarah and Ransom Williams farmstead site by Doug Boyd, and then, you know, work by Nitra Lee, work with oral histories from Maria Franklin. So brilliant scholars have done work on this site. And I was like, well, what new can be said? What new can be interpreted from this particular collection? And the fragments of shoes felt like a really possible opening. And part of it is because, you know, clothing and adornment artifacts, as I had talked about the last time that we spoke, and as I talk throughout the book about, oftentimes don't get as much attention as other artifacts in an assemblage, but I'm always so interested in the kind of bigger stories that they can tell. So I was thinking about shoes mainly because, you know, these kind of early moments after slavery, you could turn towards WPA narratives and read so many stories from formerly enslaved individuals talking about shoes, and predominantly either their lack of shoes during enslavement or the memory that they have of their first pair of shoes after surrender, so after emancipation. And because of that, I was struck by just the amount and diversity of shoe components at that site. And you could think about Sarah and her husband, Ransom. They had, I believe it was 9 children total, 5 that lived to adulthood. That's a lot of feet running around, you know, a farmstead. there's a lot of feet moving about that landscape, transforming that landscape, quite frankly, working that landscape to make it viable land to sustain themselves off of, to care for themselves, their family, the animals that they care for on that site, predominantly with like horse training, equestrian work. I talk a lot about what it would have meant for them to move about that landscape to other racially segregated areas like Rose or Antioch Colony, and the kind of schools that the children would have had to walk to as well. So we get to have a really interesting conversation about the kind of racial topography that Black families at this critical moment, right? Mm-hmm. Prior to Reconstruction's unraveling, where there was so much promise in the air. So that's really what that chapter is looking at. And then turning towards the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery, I was really thinking about, you know, Sarah, after her husband passed, the children who were adults by that time that she was still living with, they migrated back to the city center of Austin. So I thought about what it had meant for families to be a part of, you know, what we consider, we talk about as like the Great Migration, but oftentimes prior to people moving in large amounts to these northern states, people were moving from rural parts of the South into urban centers. So we move from the kind of rural space of the farmstead to the urban center of Dallas, Texas. And I was really interested in trying to figure out a way to talk about Black life at the site of interment, which is what the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery offered me, is like the snapshot of what people were buried in, right, after they had passed. And I remember when James gave me access to the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery database, and he shared all of the burials that had some kind of component of jewelry with them. And I was like, what am I, like, what could there be to say? Like, what? And this is another very well-documented site, another site that has another two-volume, you know, site. You could find thick volumes that talk about the really brilliant archaeological work that took shape there. And then also the work that James Davidson himself did with his master's thesis and then his dissertation as well. So I was like, well, there's always a new question. I'm a firm believer that there's always a new question that can be asked. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this kind of quest to sort of see, you know, what could I say about Black life at the site of like interment? I turned towards the engraved objects and belongings that people were buried with to try and see if you can just get a little bit, for me, a little bit closer, a kind of intimacy with people in the past, something that's engraved, something that they had their name on it, something in my mind that could very well have been placed on them, of course, by a loved one who was burying them, but could have likely been something that they wore themselves when they were alive. And the tragic, you know, reality of the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery is that it's a series of violent encounters since the 1920s, when state officials had approved for a portion of that cemetery to be paved over for one of the street roads. And in the process of doing that, also removed all of the burial markers from that cemetery and used them as fill for that road, which meant that there were no burial markers in situ in context to tell you the names of any person that was buried at that site. And when, you know, TxDOT came in to do work at that site because they were interested in expanding the highway that ran near it, when they, you know, did this excavation work, you know, it was 1,157 individuals were disinterred from this burial space and have since been reinterred. And there's a beautiful memorial that is at this site. There's a commemoration that is at this site. And there were no names. There were no names. And you're talking about, now we are talking about, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, and we are talking about these kind of final years, right, leading up to when there was a kind of standardized documentation of marriages, of births, of death. We don't have that yet. So yeah. The documentary sources also are not going to provide a peer view into all the thousands of people who were interred at the cemetery site. So that's why I turned towards the engraved objects and belongings at this site to try and tell a kind of deeper intimacy of a story. Can we get to a name? And the name that we got to was one name, and her name is Lorena. And we know that name because it was the only legible originally gold-plated name pin, wire name pin, that was found on a woman who was likely buried in 1901 at the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery site. Wow. And I was so struck by that because other means, especially from the work that Dr. James Davidson had done to like find and locate the names of potential people who were buried at that site, a lot of it came from doing examinations of blunt trauma to ancestral remains and tracing it back to these documented instances, either in police reports or newspaper reports that could tell you who someone was. But this kind of detective work, it wasn't so saturated in the violence of it, like the violence of them passing, the violence of their disinter. There was something else about this particular whisper from the past that felt really palpable to me. So I centered on Lorena to then tell the larger story of the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery site, thinking about what it meant to name yourself, especially post-enslavement, what it meant to spell out your name across your chest. So I really, that's one of my favorite chapters. And then the concluding chapter actually looks at contemporary artists that are taking up these questions around adornment and dress in the past and reimagining them in really creative ways. So that was a lot of fun to kind of tie it all together. But, you know, we're talking, it's 2025 now. So like I said, I think it's really funny that I thought this book was going to be written out in the world in 2022. It took me until maybe the start of 2023. Yeah, I would say it took me from March into December of 2022 to have a new book proposal.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine.
To actually go out and, like, you know, have consultation, like, meetings with the archaeologists who did work at these sites. Like, I went to the Texas Archaeological Laboratory and looked at the collections from the Sarah Manson Williams farmstead. I had conversations with Maria, with Nidra. I was emailing back and forth with Doug. I had, you know, conversations with Jillian Galley about the Hermitage site. I had walked that site several times with Larry McGee, who was the lead archaeologist who did a lot of the work in the quarters area and the domestic enslaved people's homes at that site. I had gone back and forth with James Davidson about, like, the Dallas Freedman site to put together this book project. And it took a year to just get the idea down on paper. And then, you know, it took me another 2 years to write the damn thing. So I'm really excited to say out loud that I have submitted a full manuscript. I submitted a full manuscript in March of this year and got my first round of review. I got reviewer one's comments in late July, and any moment now, like in late September, I should be getting reviewer one's comments. And I'm excited about it. The reviewers seem to be excited. My editor seems to be really jazzed about it. There are no, like, major glaring hiccups. I'm going to knock on wood just in case, you know, that review comes in and it's just like, you guessed wrong. But I feel really jazzed about it right now. Yeah. So, you know, if all goes according to plan, and maybe we can talk again in 5 years.
Right.
That book hopefully will be out in the world, in my hands, in my family's hands, you know, in 2027. So, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you're sharing this story, because I feel like it's these kinds of things happen all the time, but nobody ever talks about it.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think it's really important that people see a model of, like, what happens when you find out something new about your research and things really have to shift. And, you know, that, like, it can be done and it can make it, you know, like, I think obviously in your case, like, it adds so much richness to, like, have this variety of sites and stories. And so I just think it's important, because obviously when you're in that moment, like, you're talking about how you're, you know, you get the phone call and you're crying. And I mean, who wouldn't, first of all? And second of all, but I think it's important for people, like, that are going through those experiences, or, you know, just could in the future, to hear that, like, you can come out the other side. And that's how science works.
Exactly. That is exactly how science works. And it is a process, you know, by going through the kind of grief of having to turn away from not only that collection, but I had done a lot of work with, like, the names of people who were enslaved at that site. So, you know, there's a lot of grief that goes into that as well. And then I think it's always a really wonderful exercise for people to actually look at, you know, one of your favorite authors' first books, like, look at their first book, and then look at the publication year of that book, and then look at the publication year of their dissertation. And you'll be surprised that it takes people 5-10 years to turn that dissertation into something worth, you know, into something new. I think it's also really helpful just to, like, have a kind of perspective on the length of time it'll take for these projects to come into fruition, and to give ourselves grace around it. So I'm really grateful.
Okay. Well, I don't know how this happens, but we're already at the second break point.
Okay.
It always goes so fast, but we will be right back here in a second. Okay. So obviously we just got back from our break, and while we were on break, we were just talking a little bit right there about lessons learned from that whole experience. And I thought what you said was important. So if you wouldn't mind repeating it here on air.
Yeah, absolutely. So I feel like the largest lesson learned especially when working with legacy collections. And for me, like, I have a real commitment because there's so many legacy collections out there that could use new eyes and new interpretations and new questions, you know, and to not be afraid to do that work is to really think about what kind of standardization practices on the front end need to take place to make sure that questions 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that archaeologists, scholars in the future might have can be answered. And the work that, you know, I, along with my colleagues down at the Estate Little Princess on the island of St. Croix, we've been doing work from 2017 until our final year of excavation there was the summer of 2023. We standardized that to match and mirror what the Digital Archaeological Archive of Comparative Slavery is doing. And that way, when all of our artifacts are cataloged and they go live online, there'll be more tools, really, for scholars to come back to that data years from now and ask, you know, probing questions, not only about how we excavated that site, but about the artifacts, what the artifacts can tell them about people who lived at that site. And of course, we can't account for everything, but this is really just our attempt at trying, you know, to support not only our work right now in the present, but future work as well.
Yeah. And okay, so as much as I could definitely keep talking about this, I want to switch gears a little bit. We talked last time about diving with a purpose, and I know that your underwater work has taken more of a focus since that last episode, so I'd really love to hear more about that work that you're doing now.
Yeah, I love diving with a purpose. So DWP for short, nonprofit organization dedicated to oceanic conservation and preservation of submerged heritage resources. And, you know, we've been doing work with a lot of internet, like nationally, internationally, several different projects on coral reef conservation, but also documentation of submerged heritage resources, you know, in the National Marine Sanctuaries, with the National Park Service, with the Slave Wrecks Project. A lot of good work has taken place as well, documenting ships involved in the transatlantic slave trade. And my own work with the DWP has really centered on monumentality underwater. And I've been thinking a lot about the kind of rise that we see in maritime archaeology on the transatlantic slave trade. There's so much more work being done now on ships that carried enslaved Africans across the Atlantic. And one of the questions that I ask is why? And I ask the question why, because one of the first ships to be documented as having brought enslaved Africans across the Atlantic that was recovered and like had work done on it was in 1972 with the Henrietta Marie site that was initially found by salvagers that were searching for another Spanish ship and the gold on that ship, quite frankly. And, you know, it wasn't until several years, decades later that they came back to that particular wreck site and did an actual archaeological excavation and survey of that site and recovered a beautiful assemblage that documents, you know, not only the conditions of those both enslaved and those who worked on that ship, but also a detailed understanding of the kind of commerce of the transatlantic slave trade itself. And that's the Henrietta Marie site that is a part of the Mel Fisher Museum in Key West, Florida. And Corey Malcolm was a huge contributor to that work. And I should say Dr. Corey Malcolm, a huge contributor to that project coming into fruition. And because of that site and because of the connection that Corey Malcolm made with the National Association of Black Scuba Divers in the 1990s, he reached out to them and shared about this site and about the history of it and wanted their involvement. And of course, you know, the National Association of Black Scuba Divers jumped at the opportunity. And what I've been doing is actually doing a lot of oral history, both with the archaeologists and NABS divers around how that collaboration came into fruition, because what it led to was the first underwater monument to the transatlantic slave trade, which is a plaque down at the Henrietta Marie site, about 30 miles off the coast of Key West, Florida. And since then, for about 15 years after placing that plaque in 1993, the National Association of Black Scuba Divers had been doing a pilgrimage out to that site every summer.
Yes. You're piquing my cultural anthropology here.
Exactly. So I think for me, and people have talked about this as well, and I've published work on this. I'm thinking of scholars like Gabrielle Miller, who works for the Slave Wrecks Project. We've done a lot of and had a lot of conversations around the challenge of focusing on the ships themselves, these vessels themselves, and the survey of them to talk once again, going back to my sort of quest at the Dallas Freedmen Cemetery. It's like, well, how do you talk about Black life when there's a kind of saturation and oversaturation of violence, which is what the Middle Passage was for those enslaved on those ships? So I've always been so curious, with the rise of maritime archaeology on the Middle Passage, how are archaeologists and scholars contending with and grappling with the kind of oversaturation of violence towards Black bodies, Black death on these ships? Is there a way to kind of get out of a kind of cycle around the kind of necropolitic of the ships themselves? And I think it's really challenging. And one way that I have sort of thought elsewhere about the potential for the kinds of stories that these ships can tell is really thinking about the divers that are doing work on these vessels. So I've been thinking about the experiences that divers from Diving with a Purpose, the National Association of Black Scuba Divers, have had working at these sites, and thinking about this kind of new encounters with history that happen underwater. And shameless plug, but I have a piece that's out in an academic journal called Liquid Blackness that is all about this work. It's called An Oral Ethnography of Black Breath, Soundscapes at Submerged Heritage Sites of Enslavement. And it's looking at the experience that I, along with Kamal Siddiqui and Jay Hagler, had surveying the Katilda wreck site, which is in Mobile Bay in Mobile, Alabama. And at the time, it was the only vessel to have an intact hull that, both myself, Jay, and Kamal Siddiqui dived quite literally into. So I'm thinking about, how the body then becomes a kind of medium to think about our connection, of course, to history. And archaeologists have talked about this as well, because our work is so visceral and tangible. We're literally holding things that people in the past, manipulated, gathered, wore on their bodies. I talk about that going back to my book project as well. It's very intimate to rub your finger across someone's wedding band, or to touch, the kind of bustle that a woman, the bustle fastener that a woman would have used to kind of pull together her corset. Those are intimate things. You wouldn't walk up to a stranger and do that.
Yeah. One would hope.
One would hope you would not do that. So it produces a kind of intimacy. So I've been thinking about what it means to have intimate encounters with this particular history, the history of the transatlantic slave trade underwater, and thinking about the kind of commemorative practices and commemorative acts that are taking place and are oftentimes led by this drive from African Americans to commemorate this history. So that's where some of that work is leading to right now, and building that out into a larger second book project that is really exciting right now. We're doing underwater interviews at these shipwreck sites. We're taking visitor surveys at underwater monument sites as well. So really thinking about how submergence in water produces these really interesting connections, right? Of the past, the present, the future, and how people are coming to understand their place in that, and how the aquatic really sets the stage. So it's been a lot of fun, and I'm really excited to be in a space of like dream and play work with it and have excitement, a new project. So that's what's been taking place so far. This last July, we were able to go back out to the Henrietta Marie site. And when we went out in June and relocated the monument site, it hadn't been visited in over 20 years.
Wow.
So it was nice to see it still there, right? And the monument itself, much like underwater monuments that are being built today, was made with concrete with the idea that coral growth would occur around it. And it is. And it's still growing in this way. So it was just a really beautiful experience. And I'm excited to hopefully go back again next year and do some more interviews underwater at that site, really asking people about how they feel connected to history and how water affords these new currents, right, of connectivity between past, present, and future. So that's where some of that new work is. It's definitely leaning more towards, you know, both of us and thinking about like you as a cultural anthropologist. I'm digging into my ethnography bag, and it's been really fun to think about what ethnography underwater is.
Okay, yeah. I have to ask, do you mean like literally underwater? Like,
let me tell you. I have to stress this to grant funders as well. I'm just like, I'm gonna. I mean, underwater, like underwater full face communication devices where I am underwater, the diver is underwater, and I'm asking them questions at the monument how they're feeling, what they remember. And the idea, of course, is that our environment shapes how we remember. Our environment shapes what we feel connected. And what does it mean to then ask these questions underwater where there's such a visceral somatic response to the environment itself? So we are diving deep, literally diving deep and doing this work. So yeah.
That's like a whole new level of in situ interviewing. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. It's been a lot of fun. And it's a project that, you know, it came up for me because I was witnessing these brilliant divers with Diving with a Purpose and the work that they were doing with archaeologists from NOAA, from the National Park Service, and being in conversation with them as they're training me to do this work, asking them, what is it about this work that keeps calling towards you, and being curious about that. And I'm just like, there is something here. So this project really grew from my curiosity of what people have been experiencing, what these divers have been experiencing since they first worked on a site of enslavement back in the 1990s. So it's just been really wonderful to like be in communion underwater with folks.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Well, that is a new one for me. That's incredible. I've never heard of anybody doing underwater interviewing. I am blown away, and it's really cool to end on that note. So thank you so much again for coming back on. Hopefully, you know, 4 years from now, we can do another follow-up where you're sharing your book, first of all, and hearing more about all the exciting things you're doing. So just thank you again for taking the time to come back and update our listeners on everything that you've been up to and sharing what a journey it's been. And yeah, I just really appreciate it so much.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Jessica, for reaching back out and, you know, keeping me in mind to share more of this work. So it's always a joy to come back on the show and talk it up. So I just really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at Jessica at at livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.